a remarkable number of words we use every day have their origins in the sea and seafaring. The Irish author Grace Tierney has now gathered them all together in a wonderful new book called Words the Sea Gave Us. She came into the Seascape studio today to speak about her book, and she first told me how she came to write it.
Well, I've been blogging about the history of words for about 11 years now. And they're not all nautical words, but I was running a series of words that were coastal in origin. And I felt that I was gathering enough material that I might start aim for something a little bigger and have a book that the people that enjoy the blog might dip in and out and try out something a bit longer from me.
You say in your introduction, you're not a sailor. You're not even a swimmer.
Paddling. I can do paddling.
So how come Words of the Sea?
I've been thinking about that ever since I wrote it. And I think I just started doing it because I love words from the sea. And I love being by the sea. I grew up that way. I grew up in Raheny. And at night I could hear the foghorns down in Dublin Bay. And I could hear the curlews and see the sea fogs as they'd sort of wash in over Dublin. I've always lived beside the coast. And although, yes, I do get seasick on boats. And yes, the most I'll do
even
is paddling.
Even Nelson got seasick, as I always say.
Did he? Yes. That's actually a great one to know. That makes me feel a lot better. But yeah, it's just been sort of, I wish I could say it was in my blood, but we don't have any seafarers in the family at all. I just have a passion for the sea. You show me a harbour and I'll want to go, or a lighthouse, I'll want to see it.
Yeah, like many people. Now, what you've done with your book, which is quite a lengthy book, you've taken it and broken it down into chapters.
Yeah, I just think it's an awful lot easier for people to find it. Now, in the paperback, there is an index. So if you're just curious about a particular word, you can look it up. But I wanted to group them by theme or themes that worked for me. So I do have an entire chapter that's dedicated to sail names because so many of those have such romantic names, like Moonraker or Skyscraper, that's where it came from. Gollywobbler. I mean, they're just great names and they mightn't be on every ship, but they're beautiful words. I also had a section about the crew, which was quite interesting because I discovered that all the names for the lower members of the crew were Anglo-Saxon in origin, but all the higher members of the crew that had a bit more power were actually French. They were French Norman words. Okay. So there was a bit of a class issue going on with the naming of the roles. But I had a lot of fun with the pirate chapter as well, because there's a certain romance to a bit of army hearties and shiver me timbers. Although I did discover a huge amount of things the pirates never did. So they didn't really do walk the plank. They didn't really have peg legs, which was quite disappointing, really, when I researched it and discovered
they
didn't.
What did they do as we're just on that subject?
Well, the walk the plank they did occasionally do to perhaps a rival, but they wouldn't really have done it to any of their victims or the people they kidnapped their boat and kidnapped the people. They would have wanted to ransom them back, or perhaps they might have joined the crew itself, but they wouldn't have actually pushed them off.
One word you mentioned there earlier, a skyscraper, you would get that just on a very, very big boat.
Yes, exactly. The ones that have lots of sails. And it wouldn't have been used very often because it was right at the top and only if you were almost in a dead calm.
Now, can I throw words at you at random?
Oh, God. You can, but okay. I reserve the right to look it up.
Okay. A pig. A pig is a bad thing on a boat.
Yes. A pig is apparently a very bad thing in a boat. So if you saw a pig when you were walking down to embark, that would be it. You weren't going to sail that day. You were going to turn around and go back home. And you definitely wouldn't have wanted to have a pig as a member of your crew for dinner, perhaps. It would have been other animals. Although they did have their way of getting around bad luck, which was to touch iron. So they would have had a horseshoe nailed up somewhere. And that might get you out of trouble. But really, you wouldn't want to take the chance.
There's another gruesome one that I came across, Sweet Fanny Adams. It now means nothing, but it had, the origins are really incredible.
They're just awful. And funnily enough, that's caught a few people's eye because I think we all think, SFA, Sweet Fanny Adams. It's obviously a nice way of something of saying something else, but it originated with this poor girl who was a victim of quite obviously a sociopathic killer who murdered her and
in
chopped
the 1800s.
Her up. Yeah, it was just a dreadful story. Obviously grabbed public attention because it was such a horrendous thing, and to a child as well. And then subsequently, when the naval rations were issued and they weren't the best of meats, they were tinned, And it became that that was the sweet Fanny Adams. They were making a grim joke about the quality of their food.
Because she had been dismembered and chopped up into unrecognisable pieces.
This is it, yeah.
You have several words or phrases of Irish origin. By hook or by crook? It's one we use all the time.
Oh, we do. And I go with the Irish version because I'm Irish, but realistically it might not be. So we do have the story of Cromwell coming over to Ireland and that he was going to land by either by crook or hook heads. However, it does go back further in time than that. It was used before Cromwell's time. And I'd like to think that it was probably he had heard it and then he was the one that popularised it. Certainly in Irish history, we always associate it with Cromwell's landings, but it would have been used by earlier English landers on the south coast as well, because you really didn't want to be swept around to the west coast, as of course the Spanish Armada discovered in the 1500s. You didn't want to go up there if you didn't have decent charts, and most people didn't have decent charts at that stage. So, yeah, it would have actually started on land, in fact, rather than on sea. So I kind of snuck it into the book.
Okay, so you landed by hook or by crook heads. Yeah. Aran Sweater, the eponymous Aran Sweater.
Absolutely. That actually came from an earlier book of mine, which was all about eponymous words. But it had enough of a link to the sea to sneak into this book as well. So clearly it comes from the Aran Islands. And there's a certain amount of false stories about that one as well. There's a lot of myths out there that, oh, every jumper was completely unique and you would identify the fisherman by the jumper. The jumpers were unique because the women made up the patterns out of their heads because they were such great skilled craftspeople. But if somebody was washed up, they knew who they were looking for. The population was small enough, and a lost fisherman is not something a coastal community misses.
They were quite rough garments, heavy. Also, they had a bit of waterproof.
Absolutely, because they wouldn't have pre-treated the wool, so it has a natural lanolin in it, which is an oily type substance, which is good for the sheep to stay dry and also for the fishermen. And they wouldn't have been that lovely creamy beige colour either. That was only introduced when they started making smaller ones for people for their Holy Communion and their confirmation. You wouldn't go in your suit, you'd go in your lovely new jumper, your Guernsey. Obviously fishermen aren't going to wear something that light coloured and get it home intact.
A red herring.
Yeah, red herring. Well, I was quite intrigued by this one because
it's one of your longer pieces on it, actually.
Yes, I didn't think this was going to be a nautical one at all. I was convinced this had nothing to do with fish, that in fact, it was a red herring itself. But herring, of course, when you smoke them, do turn red. And some of the earlier mentions of it is about laying a false trail. So you would use the strong smell of the smoked fish to trick away your pursuers, either your criminal running away or you're doing it in cross-country pursuit. And that's it. You've got a lovely smelly fish. They're not going to smell you. They're going to smell the fish.
OK, so they're following a false trail or a red herring.
Absolutely. And clearly, herring history is just huge. I could have written an entire book about the history of herring because it had such an influence in coastal communities around all of the British Isles. And even Copenhagen is named for the herring. It was a free harbour. So it was built on the back of the herring shoals, as were many towns and cities around the British Isles and Northern Sea.
It was the lifeblood of that fish was the lifeblood of coastal communities.
Well, it was huge. The catch was enormous. It was in, you know, the millions every year. And back then, well, I think we should all still be eating fish, but it was an even more popular dish because of Lenten obligations and Friday obligations on the Catholic faith. So there was even a battle of the herrings between the French and the English. So that'll show you how important it was.
What words are in everyday use now that you've found?
I was surprised by how many I found that are very modern. So things that you might say in an office, like, oh, I want to clear the decks before I start in the new project. Skyscraper, obviously. Cyber comes originally from a Greek maritime word. Slush fund, I quite enjoyed. It's rather gruesome. Slush fund is really quite gross. So if you haven't eaten yet, hold on to your stomachs. So the slush fund was a special perk of the cook on the sailing ships because they could skim off the fat that would rise to the top as they were boiling up the mutton or the meat for the officers and crew's dinner. That would float up to the top. They'd skim that off and store it in a barrel. And there was always plenty of barrels because once you'd used up supplies, you had an empty barrel. They'd store that, as many barrels as they could get, on their nice long voyage, surely going to the most stinky, rancid gloop you can think of. But it was valuable because you would then sell that on to tanneries and to chandlers when you landed on shore. And they got that perk. So they got the money out of that. It was money that was deferred. It was their little savings account for when they landed. They might have spent all of their pay, but they still had their slush fund. Of course, in more modern times, that's used perhaps for corruption and bribery. And it is associated with politicians, rightly or wrongly. But that was where it started. It was your lovely barrel of gloopy grease.
Many words used on aircraft and in flight terms come from ships. A cockpit?
Absolutely. Cockpit, galley, touch and go. There's a selection of ones which are all related to aeronautical things. And I actually have to acknowledge one of my friends in the writers group, Paddy Callahan, who's a former pilot and also somebody who's a sailor as well. He tipped me off that there was going to be a connection there to go looking. And I found so many of them. Nearly all the crew names. And it goes even further than that. It goes into spaceflight as well. So there's a reason why it's a spaceship, because all the terms are the same. You still have your cabin. You still sometimes have your bosun's whistle. It all transfers. So the ships were, in essence, the spaceflight of their day. They were the fastest thing. If you were on a flying T-ship, a clipper, you were going as fast as you possibly could. And when we headed into the skies, all that terminology went with you. You had your pilot, for example. And we even have hammocks, which we get thanks to Christopher Columbus, who was definitely a sailor rather than a pilot. He and his crew brought those back from South America, and the word actually came from Haiti. Brought it back 1492. The sailors took one look at the hammocks, which had been used by the natives to basically keep themselves away from biting insects on the jungle floor, and went, that could work on a boat. We're not going to fall out of that. That can be stored. It gives us more space under below decks. But where do they end up? They end up on the lunar landing module for Apollo 11. They slept in hammocks on the moon. I had no idea. So you've got it the whole way back from Christopher Columbus to the moon.
There's a lot of fashion or clothing terminology here. Blazer was one that caught my eye.
I must say, I was thinking about blazer this morning. I'm so glad I was never in the Royal Navy. Hats off to anybody who did it, because it was a tough old life, but they just made it worse with their decisions on uniform. So for hundreds of years, they didn't actually have a uniform in the Royal Navy. You wore whatever you had, and if it wore out, it wore out. Finally, they decided they would have what were known as slops, and that's where we get sloppy from. A sloppy dresser is somebody who is dressed from the slop's chest on board. Typically the cheapest owl rubbish they could pick up and port, because they were going to be giving it out free to the crew and it'd probably get ripped, etc. Although they're probably fairly good with their little ditty bag of doing their sewing. So that was great. They then had clothes they could wear. They wouldn't wear them on shore because they were wrecked, but they had their slops. After that, the next step was, what would they wear if somebody important came to visit? So if you had an inspection by an admiral, or Queen Victoria was going to visit your ship, you wanted your crew to look good. That all came not out of the Royal Navy's pocket, but out of the pocket of the captain, who might be generous or might not. Some of them decided to go with themes. So the poor sailors on the HMS Tulip were dressed in green suits with flowers in their caps. And I'm sure they absolutely loved it. The Caledonian, not so bad. They just went with a bit of tartan because of the Scottish theme. And then blazer was the one that actually stuck. So they went with the traditional navy double-breasted blazer and your little stripy top, which eventually actually became naval uniform. But they were the smart, snappy dressers, not HMS Tulip. God love them.
The bikini?
Not worn in the Royal Navy.
Yeah.
I'll grant you that. That one's a simple enough one. As somebody, a clever marketeer, they'd recently had the nuclear tests on the Bikini Atoll Islands in South Pacific, I think. And because it was in the news, he knew if he launched his daring new swimwear with a very good looking young lady modelling them, printed with newspaper print to be even more newsworthy, that would make the headlines. And sure enough, it did. Although it did take some time for certain countries to make it legal and acceptable to wear a bikini, because it was a bit scandalous at the beginning.
The Beaufort scale, we use it still today. It's going out of fashion a little bit, but...
A little bit, but you know, I think it's one of those ones that we'll probably always use, because terms like hurricane and gale and storm, yes, we like our red and yellow warnings and they're fine. Well done to the Met Office. But in normal layman's term, if you tell me it's going to be stormy, I know what you mean. Now, the person that came up with a good scale for that and a proper definition was Sir Francis Beaufort. So he's, I suppose, a former neighbour of mine. He was from Navan and County Meath, so he's a good Irishman. But he had realised that although captains were sending back weather reports in their ship's logs, and when they landed back, they would give their weather reports back to the Navy, that they were all very subjective. So one person's storm was another person's at, was only a little bit windy. So he codified that by how much sail the ship would have up or how much the wind would be blowing smoke from cook fires, etc. So he put together a proper scale for that. And he was a great man for making things precise. And I think that came through in his entire career, which was enormously lengthy. So he joined the Royal Navy when he was only 15. By the time he was 16, he had been shipwrecked because of bad charts, which came back around in his career later on when he became the head chart maker for the Royal Navy. And some of his charts are still in use today, apparently. Mm-hmm. He worked until he was 80. Now, that is a long working life for anybody. But he was an amazing scientist, really, as well. He was friends with Charles Babbage, who invented the first computer. I think I have a story in there that he introduced Charles Darwin to the captain of the HMS, or not HMS, but to the Beagle, and got him introduced there, got him his job, essentially. And he has things named after him in the Arctic and in the Antarctic. I think he's maybe a quiet Irish hero that a lot of us don't know that much about.
Naval battles is another chapter you have. What words have come from those?
A lot of that was about sort of running a tight ship and the amount of discipline, which again brings us back to the Royal Navy. Now, the entire book isn't about the Royal Navy, but this concept of being flogged around the fleet, that if you'd erred sufficiently, you were going to be whipped significantly on the boat of every ship in the fleet. I mean, that could be 100, and realistically, you weren't going to survive it. Or you could be keel-hauled, which, again, fairly grim. The Navy knew how to punish you. You'd be literally tied hand and foot and slung underneath with your back ripped open by the barnacles on the hull of the ship. I mean, again, horrible. And they might even let you up, let you get your air and send you back down again.
It's a fascinating read, Words the Sea Gave Us by Grace Tierney. Where can we get it?
Amazon is probably your best bet if you want a paperback, and then ebook. I have it again on Kindle and Apple Books and Kobo, but anywhere you can find it is fine by me. And the blog is actually wordfoolery.wordpress.com, and there's quite a few free nautical words on there if you want to have a dip in and see the type of things I write.
And that book by Grace Tierney is called Words the Sea Gave Us. Really enjoyable to dip in and out. We've been hearing about the Tour de France over the last 2 weeks and how the Irishman Dan Martin is doing really well there. But there's another huge sporting event which is ongoing in France at the moment, and another Irishman, Tom Dolan, is among the leaders. The Solitaire de Figaro is one of the biggest and toughest sail races in the world. As the name suggests, it's solo sailing and the last leg gets underway tomorrow. Meathman Tom Dolan is in fifth place in this marathon, out of 35 starters. I spoke to a very tired Tom earlier today on a poor phone line from France.
Yeah. I'm really, really, really happy with how things have been going so far. Really, really delighted, actually. Yeah, I did a lot of work this year on myself. I suppose less on the boat. I haven't really touched the boat that much, but I've done a lot of work on myself, on physical and mental preparation, and I suppose it's really kicked off. It's really worked.
They're saying about you that it's the mental preparation that you've put in is making the difference. What did you actually do?
I had a bit of a problem with that. When I was behind in races, I was kind of breaking down in a way. It turned out I didn't have much self-confidence, actually, because I would very quickly start falling apart and saying, Jesus, what am I doing here? I shouldn't be here. You know, these are the best sailors in the world, and I'm just some little cold sheep and something needy. Who am I kidding, you know? And I actually went to a psychotherapist, believe it or not, and she found out, helped me figure out why I was thinking that, and helped a lot, yeah, to be honest. So now, even when I'm behind her, when I'm last, I manage to give the sail just like I would when I'm first. It's mad, just kind of wipes my head clear, if that makes sense. It's mad, yeah, because I never put that much importance on mental preparation. I knew it was important, and then you had to do it, and you know, I'd write a little cringy slogan on the boat, and that was about it, and I'd never give up or whatever, but I didn't realise that it wasn't actually going in. And then, you know.
It also seems to me that you, at the very start, I think I was there last year when you started off, you went very hard at the start. You were a bit more conservative this year.
Yeah, I was. Yeah. So the last year was a complicated one. I ended up the wrong side of messed up the weather forecast, to be honest. And came into Kinsale like 12 hours behind the leader, so like the race was more or less finished. So it was a bit of a tough point as well. But just to be honest, the fact that my head is a lot clearer and I feel a lot better, helps me make decisions. And also because I'm less tired, I've a lot more energy than I was the same time last year.
You have three legs down and one to go.
Yeah, we just got the race course there about 20 minutes ago. Yeah. So we have a little short one, an 80-mile course. They should put it short because the last one was so long. And hopefully it shouldn't make that much of a difference time-wise. Well, never touch wood, never say never. Because the thing about this solitary, if you go, is it's a race against time. Usually in international regattas and stuff like that, it's all point system, so you get points for whatever way it takes to finish. But now, the interesting thing about this one is it's all about time, so you could win three legs and then lose 3 hours in the last one and end up last. So.
Well, you're only, after more than 10 days at sea, you're just about an hour and a half off first place.
To be honest, I haven't looked at it yet. I'm kind of suspicious. The last three legs, I didn't look at the general ranking because I didn't want it to influence on how I failed. So, but I think now I can.
The first leg you had looked pretty tough to me. You went for France around the Fastnet and back.
That was a long one, yeah. It was good. The weather wasn't that complicated, but it was a bit of a speed race. But that was the first realised that I was actually going well and going quickly. You know, it was kind of nice to be ahead at the Fastnet. Yeah, those boats out the first time. I mean, I failed on that, I don't know how many times, but it was like boats out with Irish flags and everything, so it was really pushing.
The one now you've just finished, you finished the day before yesterday, it was the longest.
Yeah, we were 4 days at sea. It was really a tough one. The weather was very complicated, and we had a lot of passages where we had to do lots of places we had to sail through with very strong tides, so the Alderney races and then the west of France before. And there was a lot of swinging on and off to the leader. The leader of the thing actually changed 45 times.
It was relatively light wind, so it's much trickier.
Yeah. Light wind, a lot trickier. Light wind, strong tides, so a lot of. And every tough passage just happened to be at around 4 or 5 in the morning, so exactly when you're the least. But there's very little sleep, so they didn't get any sleep for 36 hours.
How much sleep would you say you've got over those 4 days?
I don't know, 4 or 5 hours maybe in total.
Okay, so you're still recovering from that?
Yeah, I am. I'm a bit broke up, to be honest. My back's a bit, and my knees are swollen up.
How's the boat going? There were new Figaro boats last year.
Grand, yeah. Like, we had a lot of teething problems, I suppose, with the them. A lot of water coming in all over the place. So it's flying now, yeah.
The Figaro, it is one of the biggest sporting events on the French calendar. Coincidentally, it's going on at the same time as the Tour de France.
Yeah, I haven't been watching the Tour de France that much at all, but I know there's an Irish fella doing fairly well. So
there is.
Nice to see. It's on at the same time, yeah. It is one of the big. It is probably the most difficult and competitive offshore race there is in the world, I think.
When do you set out again?
Tomorrow at 6 o'clock Irish time.
And it's a relatively short leg?
Yeah, it's only 24 hours, so it's not kind of the same thing. It's very intense, very, you have to get straight into it. And we're basically only just going out for a night because it's like we'll be starting just a drunk one night without sleeping and back in, and then it's all over.
A long rest beckons after that.
I stopped sleeping for a week, sleeping easy. So hopefully, celebrate.
How is the fleet managing with the COVID restrictions?
It's a bit, well, the whole thing is kind of behind closed doors in a way, you know, there's way less people come onto the control unit, people come onto the pontoon, there's no events, usually there's big, you know, galas and dinners and parties and everything, all that canceled. But actually, once we're at sea, it's gone, so we're on our own in the boat.
The best of luck.
Thanks a million, thanks everyone for sending all the messages. I see there's all the messages on Facebook and stuff.
And apologies for the poor quality of that line. And the other Irishman in the race, Kenneth Rumble, is still in there. We heard from him on the programme a couple of weeks ago.